It was in the fall of 1989, just over 25 years ago now. I was in my third year of college and my second year as a student in the Faculty of Music. I was living in a small residence hall called the Center for Christian Studies, which housed seminary students from the various denominational colleges at the University of Toronto and other graduate and undergraduate students in various professional fields, music, medicine, and law. I was one of the youngest residents there and one of the few from Ontario, let alone Canada. I shared my home with people from China and the United States, Europe, and Central America. It was a fascinating year for me, with rich and sometimes painful cultural and political conversations. It was certainly a blessing to live with people who might be models for how to get through the deconstructing and reconstructing of habits and understandings that was happening to me during my college years. And also, looking back, it made me reflect on how it trained me to understand what seminary might be like eventually. It also meant that I paid attention to the goings-on in the world around me in a little more attentive way than I might have had I just been living with a building full of other very young adults from Ontario away from home for the first time. That was most clear in October and November of that year as we all gathered around the television set. There was no World Wide Web yet. Every evening to watch the news about the upheavals in Europe. And I remember sitting there beside my dorm mates from Pennsylvania and Beijing and Edinburgh as, a little more than 25 years ago, we watched the Berlin Wall come down. I was young enough to have never known a world without that wall, never known a world that didn't have the Cold War posturing of the United States and the USSR and their allies and puppets as the context of all world affairs, never known a world without the threat of nuclear Armageddon. And suddenly, it seemed suddenly, although clearly it was building for months and years, with the fall of that wall, the world was a new place. It seemed like a fresher, freer, more hopeful place. That wall which kept people in and kept people out, depending on which side of it you were standing on, that wall which symbolized oppression and fear and tyranny was gone. And in its place was uncertainty and grief and hope. And so, inspired by the fall of the Berlin Wall earlier this year, I want to ponder with you today borders and walls and boundaries a little bit. Share with you some thoughts of mine, some words of others, and ask you to ponder the notions of boundaries and borders. I know it is your theme for this month. What do borders truly mean? How do we set boundaries? How do our faith or our ethical and spiritual commitments call us to interact with others? Now, of course, the fall of that wall did not end oppression and tyranny in the world for all of time. It did not stop the building of other walls or the shoring up of ones that were already there. Like Ursula Le Guin's wall, we all human beings build barriers, physical and imaginary, to keep things out and to keep things in. Walls to contain the vastness of things we don't understand. Fences to define what is right and just. We build the walls of buildings, of homes, of congregations, of schools, assemblies, and parliaments, theaters, and prisons. We build the walls of just expectation and correct understanding, theologies and philosophies, schools of thoughts and creeds. We build invisible borders between nations, between economies, between climates, between urban and rural spaces, between civilization and nature. We are, it seems, a border-making species, obsessed with knowing who is in and who is out, who is us and who is them, whose lives matter and whose lives don't. A couple of years ago, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, Peter Morales, pointed out the things that he felt we as religious liberals needed to understand and act on to continue to be relevant, to thrive, and to make a difference. He said that we needed to, quote, get religion, grow leaders, and cross borders. Now, there's lots in there to grapple with, but let's look at crossing borders today. He continued and said, "Our challenge is to learn to reach beyond the confines of our personal, social, and cultural experience. This is what I mean by learning to cross borders. We particularly need," he said, "to cross the borders of race, culture, and social class. Ultimately, crossing borders is about learning to be fully alive and fully aware." I think Morales was pointing to the fact that in our social and political worlds, it is often the setting of what seem at the time to be rational, reasonable boundaries, laws, policies, borders, that can lead to oppression and dis-ease and conflict. And that it is in the active, conscious, and faithful examining and crossing and challenging of those borders that the most powerful social change happens. When we question the boundaries and borders around our institutions, we can bring new hope and freedom to ourselves and others. The boundaries of theological ideology, the boundaries, the borders of the institution of marriage, the boundaries of who is worthy to be heard, the boundaries of what we teach our children about ourselves, themselves, and the world. Now, I have spent the last 3 years in Las Vegas. It's my first time living in the Southwest. And there in Arizona and Nevada and California, our discussions are arguments, honestly, about the border between the United States and Mexico are painful and loud these days. We engage in them from a place of fear and scarcity. Now, the issues are complex, and our national and local debates about them grow out of fear and paranoia as well as out of concern and compassion. But the border does not exist separate from the cultural, historic, and economic context in which it sits. Trade policy, past and current, racism, scarcity, familial bonds, colonialism, and international law all play crucial and interconnected, interwoven parts in the reality of the current situation. It's a vast and a complex issue. And while I want to avoid simple thinking about the border and immigration, I want to encourage you to ponder deeply and fearlessly. We have to do that in a larger context. The context for us, I think, of compassion and of humility that will allow us to see those crossing that border as human beings in need, not as statistics or legal cases, but as people. I will say clearly that any situation solution that requires or supports threatening children who are fleeing violence and terror with more violence and terror, any solution that ignores the reasons for their emigration, any solution that finds any resonance with the statement, "not my children, not my problem," is not a solution that is tolerable or acceptable. Crossing borders means that we allow ourselves to inhabit the borders of our certainty, to stand at the place where our understandings meet with different or opposite understandings, to be vulnerable with each other, and to grapple with ourselves and our understandings there. There, perhaps, we can find room for growth and hope. And I know that this congregation and other congregations in Madison have been grappling with those boundaries and borders around who is worthy and who is just in this city for the last years. Now, at the risk of creating a boundary where there isn't really one, I'd like to shift now from borders in the external world to pondering the borders and boundaries we create and build in our interpersonal lives, in our homes, in our intimate relationships, in our workplaces. In our interpersonal lives, writes Charles Whitfield in Boundaries and Relationships, a boundary or a limit is how far we can go without comfort, with comfort in a relationship. It delineates where I and my physical and psychological space end and where you and yours begin. Awareness of these boundaries is crucial to healthy relationships, of course. We've been told often that not having solid boundaries allows us to take on other people's needs and issues in ways that are not healthy for us or that other person. But it's not enough just to build walls between us, shutting ourselves off from everyone else completely. We're not setting up battlements and barbed wire, as Sting sang. We can't thrive cut off from everyone else. And so we have to craft healthy boundaries, boundaries that allow us to be intimate and to interact honestly and lovingly with others, but which allow us to be sure what emotions and needs are ours and what are those of other people. Boundaries that allow us to be responsible to each other, but not necessarily for each other. Whitfield points out that unhealthy boundaries are set for us by others and can be harmful sometimes, manipulative, dominating, and rigid, while healthy boundaries are clear, firm, flexible, and receptive. And learning how to set personal boundaries is a lifelong process. Knowing for ourselves what is safe and what is harmful to us and to others is ongoing work and is not necessarily intuitive at first. This is why teaching and exploring relationships and decision-making and self-awareness and boundaries are such a large part of the Our Whole Lives sexuality education curricula that we Unitarian Universalists develop and teach in our congregations. Knowing who we are, knowing what we need and how to ask for it are central skills to negotiating life and to relationships. And I want to share with you that this became more live. I'd always known how important Al was, but it became so much more live this past year in Las Vegas, in Clark County, as we've been committed to teaching Al regularly, especially because we are in the context of a conversation going on in the school district about sex ed curriculum and the needs of that community. A conversation that includes people, not Unitarian Universalists, people saying things like, I don't see any problem with not teaching about homosexuality. Those people don't exist. They shouldn't exist. Why are we teaching this? And being very supportive of abstinence-only education. It's very live for us, this understanding of Al, so I want to share with you that it's a really important and life-saving thing. And it's also why the work that we do, learning to be appropriately vulnerable in our work together as congregations, is so crucial. Instinctively retreating behind solid barriers at the first signs of conflict may feel safe, but it doesn't allow for understanding or for healing or for creative possibilities. When we allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough that we can be curious about others, even when we are in painful conflict with them, growth and healing become that much more powerful and possible. And so the setting of appropriate boundaries seems crucial then to our emotional and spiritual health and the health of our relationships. And yet, the poets and the mystics strive to point us in a different direction. The poet Lynn Unger writes, "The world comes in at every pore, mixes in your blood before breath releases you into the world again. Did you think the fragile boundary of your skin could build a wall?" And Soigal Rinpoche says, "Think of a tree. When you think of a tree, you tend to think of a distinctively defined object. But when you look at it more closely, you will see it has no independent existence. When you contemplate it, you will find that it dissolves into an extremely subtle net of relationships that stretch across the universe. The rain that falls on its leaves, the wind that sways it, the soil that nourishes and sustains it all form part of the tree. As you think about the tree more and more, you will discover that everything in the universe helps the tree make the tree what it is, that it cannot be isolated from everything else. And every moment its nature is subtly changing." Perhaps this is what we feel when we step away from the structures and imaginings of our human civilization and step beyond the walls we have built into direct encounter with the rest of the natural world. When we hike on a mountain, or stand on the shore of the lake, or gaze upward to the moon and stars beyond, it's not just that we breathe cleaner air or hear different noises. We see broader horizons and deeper distances. There is no barrier between us and the moon but distance. Nothing standing between us and the depths of the ocean or the dust of the Milky Way but time. We are a part of all of life, the vast interconnected web of existence. And we claim this experience as central to the principles that bind us together as a religious people. Long before the Unitarians and the Universalists merged their traditions in the 1960s, and long before our seventh principle was formulated in the 1980s, our theologians and thinkers understood that recognizing our interconnectedness was vital. Reverend A. Powell Davies said, "The years of all of us are short. Our lives precarious. Our days and nights go hurrying on, and there is scarcely time to do the little we might. Yet we find time for bitterness, for petty treason and evasion. What can we do to stretch our hearts enough to lose their littleness? Here we are, all of us on this planet, bound together in a common destiny, living our lives between the briefness of the daylight and the dark. Kindred in this, each lighted by the same precarious flickering flame of life. How does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? How strange and foolish are these walls of separation that divide us?" And there is the paradox. We need boundaries and borders, and we need to not have them as well. At the same time the Berlin Wall was falling, I was reading a book that was popular at the time by Sheldon Kopp. It was called If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. It's a book about psychological and spiritual health. Now, near the end of the book, he quotes what he claims is an old Hasidic saying: a person must have two pockets into which they can reach at one time or another according to their needs. In the right pocket must be the words, "For my sake was the world created." And in the left, "I am dust and ashes." We live, he claims, in the constant balance between these two realities, our importance and our smallness. And I'm reminded of this as we ponder boundaries and borders, as we live in the constant balance between the necessity for boundaries and borders and the necessity for intimate connection. As we live with the reality of separate existence and the reality of interdependence. As we proclaim the inherent worth and dignity of the individual and the fact of our participation in the interconnected web of all existence. Knowing ourselves and our relationships to all things, like Soigal Rinpoche, may we reject our isolation from others and from the cosmos. Knowing ourselves and our uniqueness, like Chester and Wilson, may we step into new relationships, welcoming new patterns and new play. Knowing ourselves and our commitments to our values, may we act always with steadfast faithfulness to each other and for the thriving of life and the triumph of love. May it be so.